it's not that failure is not an option, but it's that choosing to not recover from failure is not an option. That's always been my, I've always allowed myself to feel badly for maybe, 48 hours maximum. And then I find that actually when I really feel at my lowest after something hasn't gone the way I wanted it to, or I've failed to do something, you know, through commission or omission, the only thing I can do that makes me feel better is to take action. You know, it's probably the wrong metaphor, but I'm much better on the attack than on the defense.
Welcome to another episode of The Brand Called You, a vodcast and podcast show that brings you leadership lessons, knowledge, experience, and wisdom from hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. If you're new to our channel, please consider subscribing to it and hit the bell icon so that you never miss an update. I'm your host, Ashutosh Garg, and today I'm privileged and delighted to welcome a very, very accomplished entrepreneur, a fellow YPOer from the US, Steve Pistono. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ash. Very good to be with you.
Thank you. Steve is the managing director of SE Advisors LLC. He is the former president of Sea Rainbow Group, an Asia-based producer of innovative educational toys and games. And as I just mentioned, he is a fellow member of the YPO. So, Steve, let's talk a little bit about SE Advisors and your long stint in China. Tell me about SE Advisors and what do you do?
Well, SE Advisors is really kind of the vehicle through which I manage and accomplish my business life post the divestiture of my last operating company in China. So I think I established it 7 or 8 years ago, and it was always kind of on a parallel course with all the other things that I was doing. And now that I've, as of April of 2019, divested the toy and game business through a sale to a French strategic acquirer, SE Advisors LLC has, I suppose, become almost a kind of small-scale family office where it holds real estate assets. I use it to engage in some sell-side advisory work, some consulting, still some sourcing and trading activities. So I think when you're someone perhaps like us who sort of moves through a career in multiple parts of the world, you always want to have that thread of continuity that kind of organizes your business life and all the things you do in parallel to your main career.
Fascinating. So, you know, you lived in China for almost for over two decades, and you also speak Mandarin.
Yes.
What made you decide to go to China?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Well, to take it back to its roots, there are really two answers. One is professional and one probably more personal. On a professional level, I became interested in Asia when I was in college. I did a government concentration, and I focused my senior year writing a thesis on the politics of Japanese political modernization post-World War II. So I became very interested in that part of the world, by extension, Greater Asia, China, Taiwan, those areas, and decided it would be interesting to go and live and work in Asia. On the other hand, I come from an immigrant family. My father's family immigrated from Italy. My mother's family immigrated from Sweden. And I think at a very basic level, I had a desire to kind of recreate that immigrant experience and go somewhere where I didn't speak the language, I didn't know the people, it was all very foreign to me. And Asia was about as foreign as I could manage. Japan was a little tricky for various reasons, so I ended up going to Taiwan. And that was my first entree and first exposure. That's probably why I speak Chinese now and not Japanese.
Fascinating. And you know, you spent a long time in China, you worked in Taiwan and in other countries. China, which is the manufacturing powerhouse of the world. What is it like to do business there?
Well, I would say different, but the irony there is that I don't really know what it's like to do business in a place like the US, for example. Okay. So contrasting, it's a little bit difficult, but I can say that doing business in China was always engaging, sometimes very frustrating, quite dynamic. The environment changed rapidly and sometimes quite unexpectedly. I found the people that I worked with to be, for the most part, very good colleagues, very industrious, very focused on, you know, achieving and bettering their situation. So I used to have a metric that I found very satisfying when I worked in China, which was when we started, you know, we literally started with myself and two employees, and we ended up, my first company, we ended up with about 1,700 employees. So it grew quite rapidly in terms of headcount and also just, you know, the size of the business. But we used to have a Chinese New Year's party every year. And it was always fascinating to see how every year the employees that showed up to the party, you could tell they would be dressed better. They would have a higher degree of affluence. So you could almost visually chart the development of the country through the way people presented themselves every year at the Chinese New Year's party. So that was, for me, kind of a metaphor of the development of China. You know, we saw it develop economically, we saw it culturally. Now, obviously, in recent years, there's been a little bit of a pullback on some fronts, but the dynamism has certainly continued.
Amazing. And how important is it to know the local language to do business there?
Well, for me, in my first position there, it was really a survival skill, because my colleague, whom I had joined in a joint venture based in Shanghai, a couple of months after I arrived, had a sort of catastrophic fall and broke his hip very badly and had to be medevaced back to the US for surgery. And he never returned.
Wow.
He was American Chinese and spoke Mandarin and Shanghainese. And after he left, I was in this huge joint venture, very traditional joint venture, and virtually no one spoke English. So I had to learn Mandarin very, very quickly. And I had 10 hours a day of intensive Mandarin to get up to speed. So it was critical then. And for the rest of my time in China, it was very, very useful. I wouldn't say it was absolutely essential, but it was. And of course, you enjoy the country that much more.
I agree with you. I agree. So, you know, you have your experience with China is fairly recent. You just sold your business a year ago. Tell me what in your opinion has been the impact of the pandemic on China and Chinese businesses?
Well, certainly the initial impacts were when Wuhan was shutting down. It was quite severe. You know, factories were closing. I have to say that for me, this pandemic was not my first experience with this. I mean, I was in China all through SARS in the early 2000s. And I remember, you know, there's almost an apocalyptic sense, you know, that I recall from that time. And I think that translated forward in time to the beginning of this current pandemic. But the government and the people had strategies they could fall back upon from SARS. You know, they could very quickly bring out, not that it was as effective as it might have been back then, but the temperature sensing equipment. And everyone sort of knew the drill and could go into a lockdown situation, go into a mask wearing situation. It was much easier than, I think, in some West.
Interesting. And, you know, when you look at your two decades in China, you I think you must have been there when Mr. Deng Xiaoping was running the business.
Well, kind of right. My earliest memories of China, to be honest, are post-Deng.
Okay.
I was there during Jiang Zemin and Zhu Rongji. Yeah. Zhu Rongji.
And Hu Jintao after that. And then.
Yeah. Yeah, and I remember, I have very fond memories of Jiang Zemin, to be honest, and Zhu Rongji. I had a lot of respect for those guys. And obviously then I went to Hu Jintao and forward. Now we're with Xi
Jinping. As you look back at the last two decades, what are some of the significant business related changes that you have seen in China over two decades?
Well, there are lots, but I would say for me, the big sea change has, and what I've had to adapt to, or I did have to adapt to, was when I went there, I arrived in 1997. Now, I had been in and around Asia for years prior with regard to Taiwan, but I was really there permanently from 1997. Mm-hmm. And in 1997, the formula for success was pretty straightforward. It was manufacturing things inexpensively, products and components, primarily for consumption in the West. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't that difficult. If you were a bit adventurous and had a high tolerance for instability and ambiguity, it was not that difficult. Mm-hmm. You could find success. That became increasingly difficult over time as costs rose, as the currency shifted and the renminbi depreciated essentially, or appreciated in some cases. And so that was a challenging environment to adapt to. It was still possible, but you had to kind of move up the value chain and do more difficult things, more precise things in manufacturing. And then sometime round about 2008 to 2010, at least for me, it became clear that there was a shift underway from the export-oriented manufacturing environment that I had developed and grown up in to a mixed model where we still manufactured OEM for overseas, but we needed to shift our focus to the Chinese domestic market. And that's what I did for the last maybe 8 or 10 years when I was in China.
That's amazing. So, you know, one of the questions that I have often wondered, and, you know, I've asked people about this also, is that what really happened in China where it actually pivoted from being a completely export-led economy to an economy which has become such a large domestic market? Is it just economic prosperity?
Well, I think part of it is economic prosperity, certainly. I think part of it is a conscious desire on the part of the central government to stimulate consumption in China. It's hard sometimes for me to puzzle out exactly what's happening at a macro level, but I can tell you at a micro level from my Chinese friends and the people I associate with, people I know, in the Shenzhen area specifically, that purchased their homes, their apartments in the early 2000s, have ridden a real wave of real estate appreciation that has increased their personal wealth significantly.
Wow.
And I think there used to be an axiom that in China, the three must-haves was like a wristwatch, a bicycle, and a radio to get married. And then after that, it became like a refrigerator and a television and something else. And now I think it's you have to have an apartment and a nice car and maybe a really nice watch. I'm not sure. But so that's really shifted, and you know, real estate just continues to appreciate. And
correct.
I think that's where a lot of the wealth was created for the sort of middle class that I know.
Correct. Correct. And, you know, also want to check with you that, you know, in a world that is becoming increasingly polarized, what do you think are the challenges China faces?
Well, they're multifold. The one that I always get back to that I don't know if people focus on, some people focus on it quite a bit, but I think is demographics. I think China has an aging problem. I think the one-child policy has created a situation where as the years progress, you have increasingly more older retired people being supported by a dwindling pool of workers. Because on the one hand, you have healthcare improving in China, so longevity increasing.
Correct.
And then you just have less young people because the birth rate has been low. And the Chinese government's trying to stimulate the birth rate and get people to have more children. I think it's having very mixed results because children are expensive in China and the Chinese people like to really take care of their kids.
Correct. And of course, you know, I was reading an article recently where I think China has announced it, the first decline in its population. So what you're saying seems to be absolutely correct.
Yeah, and I think the other challenges, to go back to your previous question, that China faces are obviously the Chinese government is perceived in some circles as becoming more aggressive in its foreign policy and diplomacy, both with regard to its neighbors as well as, you know, the Western democracies, the Western United States, Western Europe, and so forth. And I think maybe that's just a natural result of China's rise, if you will. But I think it's something that China needs to manage because I think there's a big divergence between people's perceptions of the China government and its actions versus their relations with individual Chinese, many of whom I count to be my close friends.
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, I have a lot of very, very dear friends in China. And mm-hmm. one wonders what is going on. But at a business level, things are normal. So one more question on for you on China, and then we move to the next segment.
Okay.
You know, you mentioned a little bit a few minutes ago that costs are beginning to rise in China.
Yes.
What will be the impact of rising costs on China being the world's factory?
Well, you've seen some of it with regard to low value add in terms of production moving to other places. So, I mean, much of the garment industry has already left Taiwan, or I'm sorry, left China. You know, increasingly you see Chinese companies trying to do more value add in the country and have, you know, more of an emphasis on technology and difficult processes because I think they realize that their cost advantage is eroding. Having said that, and having witnessed amongst, you know, our YPO peers, a lot of people who've done business in China trying to move to other places like be it Thailand or Malaysia or Vietnam or Indonesia. Having said that, it's proved quite challenging for many companies to find the same level of support from their subcontractors and second and third tier suppliers, because so much of the industrial infrastructure that was traditionally in places like the US and Western Europe has physically moved to China. And it's just really hard to replicate that without a tremendous investment. Okay. So that's, China has an entrenched position in many industries, and it's hard to shift that.
Fascinating. So, Steve, I'm now going to move to the next segment of our conversation, which are some questions for you personally.
Okay.
My first question to you is that as you look at life, what would you say are three key milestones in your life and your career?
Well, sure. Okay. First one would have been the decision to go to Asia. That was, I wouldn't say it came down to the toss of a coin, but it was almost the toss of a coin because I had a chance to pursue something in the US that would have taken me on a very different course. Mm-hmm. And I made a choice to go to Taiwan, and I really didn't have anything prepared. I didn't have a job. I didn't have anything in front of me. I had a one-way plane ticket and a backpack and some traveler's checks back when you could do that sort of thing. And I just kind of hit the ground and looked for a job and was fortunate enough to find something that took me in a really positive, quite wonderful direction, met my future wife. So everything in my life kind of began, if you will, at that point. So there was that. My second one, I would say, was my very first experience in China when I was working in a joint venture in Shanghai that was quite dysfunctional in the very classic, you know, Sino-foreign JV sense back in the late 1990s. At the time, that seemed like a tremendous failure. But it really kind of led me to a platform to move south in China and start something that was, I think, very successful. So that was probably the second important inflection point. And the third, to some degree, was probably the economic crisis of 2008. Mm-hmm. Because that caught me in a situation where we had just sold a quite large industrial business that I'd been involved with, that was the former division of a Fortune 500 company that had been taken private. And so I had cashed out and had my first big equity payday from that business, and didn't really know what I was going to do next, mm-hmm. but had some prospects and was still in southern China with small children in school and everyone very happy with where we were. Mm-hmm. And then the economic crisis and almost all my prospects evaporated. Right. And I was forced to go through not really a process of reinvention, but a process of realignment. Mm-hmm. And it was quite a nerve-wracking time. But in retrospect, it was, you know, quite a healthy experience to go through. And, you know, everything turned out okay.
Wonderful.
For the most part. Well, it's still turning out okay, I guess.
I agree with you. My next question to you is that, you know, for someone who's been an entrepreneur, or someone who's worked for large companies, now you are in, as you said, your own family office. What are some of the core values you believe in?
I gave this a little bit of thought because I thought we might discuss this. And I think I came up with a few that, the first one, for lack of a better way to express it, I think is courtesy. Mm-hmm. I might have said empathy, but I always find empathy a bit presumptuous. Amazing. Because with the people that I deal with around the world, some of them have such different backgrounds and life experiences than me that I think to try and kind of really place myself in their situation is almost an impossibility. But I think, to me, courtesy in the sense that I may not understand everything that motivates them, but I respect that it comes from a sincere element of their makeup, their emotional or psychological makeup. Mm-hmm. And I think as long as I respect that and they respect me, that we can get along quite well without agreeing on everything or necessarily placing the same value on different aspects of our lives. So courtesy, honor. Mm-hmm. Perhaps in a traditional sense that, you know, your word is your bond. Mm-hmm. You expect that from me. I expect that from you.
Yeah.
I would never consciously and intentionally do anything that I thought was dishonorable, mm-hmm. or bring dishonor upon my family. Mm-hmm. So I think those, and I think also, given the way I was brought up and, the way I've tried to live my life and spending so much of my time overseas in, I would say, ambiguous situations, I think self-reliance. Mm-hmm. I think the idea that ultimately you're responsible for yourself and your family and you need to, you know, you need to focus on that and not assume that someone is coming to save you, because mm-hmm. it's not likely to happen in many instances. So I think those are some of the values that I probably hold closest. I mean, and then the obvious ones like, you know, respect and care for family and things like that.
Sure. So, and a follow-up question from that is that as you look at life and from where you stand today, what does success mean to Steve?
I think what one of the things that success means to me at this point in my life is beyond things like, you know, health and the well-being of my family, I think it's independence and mobility. Mm-hmm. I think that's what I've kind of been seeking my whole life, is the ability to move in the directions that I choose to move without feeling necessarily tied to a specific institution or a specific viewpoint. You know, I think it's important to have convictions, but I think it's also important to adapt and to change one's views as appropriate, and to also just, you know, move around. I've been privileged to live and work in different parts of the world. And even though I was based in China for quite a long time, I spent a good portion of my career in Europe. So I think ultimately mobility and independence, freedom of thought, freedom of action.
Interesting. And my last question for you, and this is a question on failure.
Okay.
You've lived in China, I come from India, and I have often said that parents in South Asia, or for that matter, China, don't teach children it's okay to fail. We're always told, come first in class, go ahead of the line, etc. And that manifests itself in our behavior patterns. My question to you is that, what have been some of your learnings from some of your mistakes?
I guess one of the key learnings is just resiliency.
Mm-hmm.
I think if I go back and I try to find significant failures in my life, I'm not sure I've ever had a very significant failure, but I've had lots of small failures. And I think the lesson I've taken from them all is that it's not that failure is not an option, but it's that choosing to not recover from failure is not an option. That's always been I've always allowed myself to feel badly for maybe 48 hours maximum. And then I find that actually when I really feel at my lowest after something hasn't gone the way I wanted it to, or I've failed to do something, through commission or omission, the only thing I can do that makes me feel better is to take action. It's probably the wrong metaphor, but I'm much better on the attack than on the defense. So I have to, after 48 hours, I have to stand up and rejoin the fight.
Well said, well said. Steve, thank you so much. It has been such a pleasure speaking to you. Thank you for such amazing answers on China. I've learned many new things from you. Thank you for talking to me, and good luck.
Well, thank you, Ash. It's been a genuine pleasure.
Thank you for listening to The Brand Called You videocast and podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience, and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website, www.tbcy.in, to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for The Brand Called You.